This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And we are live. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another NBN interview. I'm Mel Rosenberg. I'm the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network. And today we have a very special guest from Toronto, Canada, Elaine Kachala, who is going to talk about her life, her career, her thoughts, and her wonderful new book, which is entitled Superpower, The Wearable Tech Revolution. Welcome to the Hello. Interview show. Yeah, it's great
Thank
to meet you.
Thank you very much. It's great to meet you too.
So you published your book with Orca, which is a great publishing house.
Fabulous.
For Canadian authors. I just decided today I'm definitely going to submit there because I'm sort of Canadian. And congratulations.
Thank you.
So a few words, could you have your book that you can like wave it and show everybody?
Yeah, of course. There it is. The illustrator, Belle Wuthrich, is absolutely fabulous. The illustrations and the design are just fabulous, just incredible in this book. Yeah,
This is a good time to show the people who are viewing a couple of the wonderful pages.
Oh, yeah. There's it's filled with many illustrations of people using wearable technology and how our whole bodies are connected to wearable technology these days. And then it's filled with photo research too, that many of the photos I received from the engineers and designers that I interviewed. And so they were so gracious in supplying photos. So it's filled with fabulous photos. Yeah, well, I could go on and show you the whole book. But I won't.
No, you'll get in trouble for that.
Yeah, yes, I might.
With your publisher. We want to be kind to publishers.
Right.
So you can pre-order this book and we will provide information. That's wonderful. So usually I interview people that have written picture books because that's my soft spot. But I also have a soft spot for technology in Canada. When you contacted me, I said, oh, wow, I'm going to go outside my comfort zone and interview someone who has written for an audience a little older. I'm guessing
it's middle grade.
Nine to 12, something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe a little bit younger, maybe a little bit older, but the age range for Orca, it's part of Orca Think series, and that's middle readers.
Wonderful. So how did this happen? You know, people who have writing deals for children's books are like one in a zillion million. Great success story. This is your first book.
It is.
It's your first interview.
First of everything. Yeah.
And I'm so excited. So start at the beginning.
Oh, wow.
Of your life.
Oh, my gosh. No, that's too long ago. Won't be here for a very long time. I started children's writing later in life, as many children writers do. And I mean, for this book, I actually did start down the path of picture books.
Do me a favor. I'm later in life. You're a youngster. But no, I wasn't being facetious. Start at the beginning.
I was born. Oh, wow.
We have time.
Yeah, born Toronto, Canada, lived in the city all my life. You know, that sounds pretty boring, but we do get out of the city and travel around about. But born and raised in Toronto. I have two daughters and a husband and a beautiful golden retriever. My daughters are young adults now, and they're 25 and 30. I can hardly believe that. And born and raised in Toronto, grew up in Toronto, just, you know, ordinary, very ordinary life, ordinary kid. Didn't have any passions about being a writer when I was young. Certainly books were part of our lives for sure. Always at the library for doing projects and that sort of thing. We read. I remember quiet reading times at home. You know, I had my book, my Nancy Drew mysteries, at the corner of the couch, and my mother was sitting beside me. Now we're in the same generation.
Yeah. No, we are not. I never read Nancy Drew. I read the Hardy Boys, and I'm a generation ahead of you or behind you, dear.
Mm. Yeah. So we, reading books, school, you know, just ordinary average kid. Did I have kind of an inclination towards fiction or nonfiction? I don't know. I remember, I remember my parents buying the Encyclopedia Britannica. Do you remember that? And a hard copy of this massive, huge leather bound, I don't know how many volumes. And the Britannica Encyclopedia was white with gold painting on the pages. And I remember looking at this thinking, this is phenomenal. This is an incredible amount of information, very intimidating, but I was struck by, you know, how valuable kind of it gave me this impression of the value of information with these books. Anyways, I remember being enthralled by, you know, encyclopedias. That didn't go anywhere in terms of, you know, specific career, but, went through, you know, school years like most kids. When I left high school, when I graduated high school, I didn't have any specific passion or direction, you could say, in mind, although I had a little inkling toward the sciences and the technologies, and originally began in a medical technology program. It used to be called the Toronto Institute of Medical Technology here in Toronto. Now it's called the Michener Institute. And I trained as a cardiology technologist, ended up working in teaching hospitals, ended up in management. And originally thought I was going down the path of master's in health administration, but then that started to feel a little bit boring. And as I was doing my undergraduate degree at that time as well, in sociology, I took sociology and psychology courses, which kind of intrigued me. And I was taking a sociology of health and illness course that really sort of broadened my thinking around health and illness and kind of the social, economic, and structural factors that affect people's health. And that kind of intrigued me and changed my direction of where I wanted to go for master's work. And I relied on the fabulous advice of two mentors, two professors that I met at the time. And I ended up at the York University doing a master in environmental studies, with a focus in health policy. And so a lot of my work over the years as a health policy writer, researcher, advisor was in the area of health planning and healthcare design, but from a population health lens. And so thinking broadly about the factors that affect people's health. And so when I tackle topics, I tend to go big thinking and thinking about the connections between things. And so I think that that played a role in how I approached this work and this topic and why some of the issues in this book intrigued me. But as I said, I came to children's writing later in life. The roots of this book had their conversation. I was actually at a workshop, I'm going to say 2017, where I met editors and writers, and it was a workshop. And I was actually there to have a picture book critiqued. I had actually started down the road of thinking I could write a picture book.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and, so hold on. So how did this happen?
So when I first... before that, I guess a couple of years before that, I was just looking for a creative outlet. And I'm not a musician. I'm not an artist. So what am I going to do that's creative? Well, I have a lot of experience with writing, and we love books, and you know, picture books still from when my kids were young. And I thought,
Which ones? Which were your favorites as a kid and as an adult?
Oh, well, you know, when I was a kid, we didn't really have picture books like they have picture books now. But, you know, the classics, you know, Curious George, the Disney stories, the fairy tales, that kind of thing. But of course, you know, my kids had all so many picture books. I can hardly remember. Very Hungry Caterpillar, you know. I made a note. Robert Munch, Good Night.
Yes, I was waiting for that.
Oh, classic stories.
You're Canadian. You're Canadian.
Oh yeah, of course. I Love You Forever, that book. Oh my gosh.
I love you forever.
Yeah.
I'll like you for always.
That book made me cry.
As long as the just singing that makes me cry.
Yeah.
So so let's have a hip hip hooray for this wonderful Canadian author.
Yeah, yeah. He was in the news lately. I think his health is declining a little bit. It's set, but he's contributed so much. Yeah.
My favorite, I must say, is The Paperback Princess.
Oh yeah, yeah. I have that one too.
That doesn't make me cry.
No.
I Love You Forever makes me cry.
Yeah, it does. It does.
So I was waiting. Yeah. So okay. So you pressed the right button with this old guy.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So Robert Munch, Curious George. Okay, and then you woke up one morning, you said, "Oh, I have nothing to do today. I'll write picture books."
Well, yes, in a way. I mean, I had sort of leaked that little secret to my family, and for Christmas, my daughters bought me Ann Whitford Paul's Guide to Writing Picture Books, and I read this, and I read it, and I reread it, and I thought, this sounds doable. And I thought, you know, what's so hard about this, right? I hadn't been involved with the publishing world, and I hadn't been part of critique groups yet or any of that. And so I started playing around and thought, well, we have dog Tucker now. He's a golden retriever. Now he's 12 and a half, of course, much younger and a bit of a pup then. I thought, well, I'll write stories about him. He was inspiring. And I jumped to titles in my head, and that was sort of like my stepping point for writing a story. And so I had this banner in my head called Tucker's Tale Tells Tales. And I thought, oh, I had so many stories I can write about Tucker. So I started writing all these stories. Anyways, became involved with, Canscape and Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, and going to workshop and critique groups and drafting all kinds of manuscripts, and then probably sent them out way too early. Critique group critique, but not professionally critiqued, and you know, getting all kinds of rejections. And I happened to be at this workshop that I was mentioning in 2017 for a critique of this latest draft. Actually, it wasn't a Tucker's book. I had other stuff on the go that I was trying out. And I had this one story. It was actually I thought, well, maybe I'll go down the road of writing picture books for kids around health issues. And so seemed like a good connection. And I had this one book, it was called Brave Ally Mally. And it was inspired by my young daughter who had a fear of needles, horrible fear of needles. Anyways, I had written and rewritten this book. I don't know how many times this manuscript. It was a different book every time. And I was at this workshop for a critique, but also other sessions about this book. And just talking to editors and writers, and somehow with this one editor, we got talking about middle grade and we got talking about STEM and STEAM books, which I'm always intrigued by. My daughters work in those fields, and I'm always trying to figure out what the heck they're doing, and I'm inspired by their work. And so I thought, oh, this is sounding interesting. And we're speaking very generally about what kind of books would speak to kids at this point in time. And we'd talked about the impacts of technology on society and very broad themes. Anyways, after the workshop, raced to the coffee shop and started doing some research and thinking, oh, this is sounding interesting. I wonder what I can do here. Go back to the workshop, and I'd asked if they accept, you know, proposals. So if you're not writing a picture book, you have to do a proposal, a nonfiction proposal, which is an outline of what would be in the book and some sample chapters and, you know, a little bit of a marketing pitch and that kind of a thing. So I said, do you accept proposals from unpublished writers? Goes, oh, of course, you know, always looking for new voices. That's what's great about Canadian publishers. And I thought, oh, okay, can I send you something? And several months later, so went back home, you know, got onto this new topic, and it just became all consuming. Several months later, sent a proposal, and he quickly replied, and there were all kinds of problems with it. And it was too broad in focus, and the voice wasn't quite right. And I was learning about the topic, and I was learning about writing for middle grade. There was lots of new learning going on. But anyways, long story short, we went back and forth for up to 2 years, pretty much 2 years. He was giving me incredible advice and incredible support to keep going. He liked the idea, but I just wasn't nailing it properly. And so we went back and forth. And then finally, at about the 2 year mark, he said, you know, I think we've got as far as we can. I wish you the best of luck. But, you know, this isn't right for our publishing house. And I thought, oh, okay. But I had opened, and, you know, I was sad, but I got it. I mean, there was obviously, I had more learning to do. I'd just, you know, barely been a year kind of on this new genre that I was writing for. And I happened to be at a workshop, a nonfiction workshop for writing for kids, when I had opened this last rejection email. And the timing was perfect, because then I got feedback from the group on his feedback. And that was a real turning point for me. And I restructured and refocused and pared down the topic and did a lot more research and ultimately ended up focusing. And really, it wasn't focused on wearables until that point. And so I got to looking more deeply into the research. Oh, and I brought in my own sort of personal healthcare background. I started reflecting on what I was seeing in work. At the time, I worked for an organization called the Council of Academic Hospitals of Ontario, where our role was to advocate for health research funding. And so we worked with the research hospitals, and there was all kinds of incredible research going on there using wearables for people with disabilities. Right through, you know, from kids right through to elderly. And so I thought, why didn't I think about this before? Like, this is such a meaty topic in and of itself. And the more research I dug into, and then I started realizing or becoming aware of this kind of whole era of responsible innovation and some of the issues and challenges around responsible in order to develop technology responsibly, which I didn't quite think about from a healthcare perspective. I hadn't really thought of any of that. Such a high burden of, you know, a high level of ethics in healthcare and all kinds of committees when research projects go through. I really didn't know the outside world, and I hadn't really sort of clued in to some of the huge issues that were going on. Anyways, this made me refocus, and so I restructured the proposal, and then I got the advice of an author who I had taken a course with in the past, and he's, you know, I don't, published 100 books kind of thing. And he did a professional critique for me, and he said, oh, you really have something here. And I think you've nailed the voice, and I think you've nailed the approach, and it's not too technical. And you may want to contact Orca Book Publishers and talk to Kirsty Hudson, the nonfiction editor there. And I went, oh my goodness. And I said, "What? Well, and can I use your name? Can you connect me with Kirsty?" And he says, "Of course." So I did. And as it happens, they were just launching their Orca Think series, which is a series for middle readers that introduces kids to issues in the headlines and helping them, you know, think critically and ask questions about complicated topics. And it fit right into that series. And so that is how this story came about. Many, many threads coming together.
Okay. But they have to, because the chance of getting published is so small.
It's very challenging. Always,
yes, there's always a story behind the story. So that's wonderful. So can you, just for our listeners and viewers, give one or two sentences about what the book deals with?
Okay, so it's a gentle introduction to wearable technology, what it is, how it works, and the exciting ways that it's changing people's lives and improving people's lives in many ways. And so there are all kinds of stories about, you know, how wearables helping people survive, thrive, and live better lives. But they're computers for our minds and bodies. And so the book delves deeper into some of the challenges and dangers of the technologies, and readers meet engineers, scientists, designers who are evaluating the pros and cons of the technology, considering the idea of, can innovation go too far? And they speak with young inventors too. They're featured in the book, and they have some fabulous insights into this. And so there are little sort of catchy sidebars throughout the book that kind of prompt readers to sort of pause and reflect, like, oh, I didn't realize there were some dangers around this technology, or, maybe not everybody agrees that we should be enhancing our bodies with technology, and can innovation even go too far? And in many cases, the answer is yes, actually. We're moving into some crazy ethical territory here. And so how, you know, what are the choices we make as a society if we're going to develop this technology and put it out there so that many people can benefit? The technology also has potentially some unintended consequences, and how do we develop technology responsibly? And so the final chapter goes into a little bit of an overview of what does responsible design mean.
Okay, before I ask you the question that I had reading the book, there's also a very famous Canadian. Godfather of
Wearable computing, Dr. Steve Mann, exceptional, brilliant scientist, engineer.
Did you get to meet him?
Not in person. I was doing through this book all through COVID, and so we have not met yet. But he very graciously and quickly answered all my questions through email. He was one of the fact checkers on the manuscript, as were other engineers and designers. And he provided me with some of the fabulous photos of him in the book and the evolution of his technology. He invented augmented reality.
And a few other things.
Just a few other things.
He has many
patents and wearables. Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So here Okay, so I'm reading the book, and it's a really wonderful book. It doesn't skirt the issues. It talks about all the aspects. It talks about all the good things that wearables can do. And it also talks about the dangers to society, the dangers to the individual. And I think it's wonderful that you are bringing this to young children for whom they treat, I suppose, wearables as the same way that we drink water. And you're saying, hey, hold on a second. However, keep in mind these indeed. So, but what I'm thinking when I'm reading the book is that, is there such a difference today between a wearable watch, which I have on, and my phone, which is not a wearable, but it's in my pocket?
Right. I mean, phones are like extensions of our bodies now, aren't they? Yeah.
So you don't talk about phones too much in your book, but
no,
are they wearables or not wearables?
No, it's not attached to your body. It's not collecting well, it's potentially tracking your location and everywhere you go and everything you do, but it's not physically, it doesn't have sensors, and it's not collecting, you know, biometric data that, well, it could if you set it up that way, but it did not fall under the category of a wearable. And I guess,
It's a semi-wearable.
It's a semi-wearable. Yeah, we treat it as a wearable. We keep it in our pockets. But it's not physically integrated with your body. I mean, if you look at, I guess, Dr. Steve Mann's vision or idea of a computer and the whole concept of humanistic intelligence, it's a device that's, you know, interacting computationally, working with your body. The sensors and the computer in the wearable is tracking and sensing what your body wants to do, what it needs to do, and it's processing that information through machine learning algorithms, and then it's understanding what you need to do and then producing an output. And so it's something that's constantly on your body, constantly accessible, constantly ready to interact. That's not a phone.
I think that, so this is a big distinction, and I'm glad that you made it. And this is one of my take-home lessons from your wonderful book, is that the advantage of the smartphone isn't whether it's a wearable or not. It's that you have, it's like push. In other words, in order for it to become a wearable, you have to take it out of your pocket, open an app, touch it, press it somewhere.
Exactly.
And then it becomes a wearable, but it's you who decides
exactly
to make it a wearable.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's an important distinction.
So thank you for making that and raising this question. So are you concerned? I know, you know, you played both sides. You were kind of rabbinical in this, in this book.
Yeah.
But I'm going to now.
I think there's certainly more benefit to be gained than risk. Would I use a wearable? Yes, but cautiously. I don't have I don't have a smartphone or I don't have a smartwatch to track my exercise. When I was trying to consider the value of the wearable, I was trying to figure out, what do I really want it to do? I do have a wearable. It's one actually that was invented by Dr. Steve Mann, and it's the Muse Brain Sensing Headband. And so it's for relaxation and meditation. And there's all kinds of, there's the electroencephalograph built into this little pod here. And then it has all kinds of sensors. And so it collects information about your brain waves and your heart rate and breathing. And then, but it's connected to an app on your phone. And if you are, you know, breathing too fast and in stress mode, it will prompt you to relax through whatever app that you have on. So there's intervention. So like, I see value in that. I think as wearables get better and more sophisticated and there's more of a coaching element to it, I think that would make me buy other wearables or invest in other wearables. I think I wasn't convinced just about the data tracking.
It's funny that you don't have a watch.
I don't have a watch, and I exercise like crazy, but I didn't feel like that was something I needed. In fact, you know, sometimes wearables can, you have to know how to interpret and understand and use the data so that it's valuable for, and not also get freaked out by the data. Actually, I have a neighbor who used the smartwatch to track some sleep, and she was so stressed out by how, what information she was getting back from this wearable, because it was telling her she was sleeping, you know, 2 or 3 hours a night. And I was, how can that be? This can't be. And she ended up, you know, and as it happens, smartwatches are not accurate for many, unless it's, I haven't heard of any that are as accurate for tracking sleep as the Muse wearable that Dr. Mann's created. But so the device has to be accurate. How do you know it's accurate? How do you know it's giving you the right information? And what's the value versus the risk? So all your information is being collected by, who knew? I mean, Google bought Fitbit, right? That was a whole big fuss back several years ago when Google bought Fitbit. So it's kind of, you know, it's a value. But my daughters have, you know, they have smartwatches and they use them for.
Yeah, but your daughters, as you divulged, are now young adults. Mm-hmm. What are you going to tell the mother of a 9-year-old? My daughter wants a smartwatch.
Yeah.
For her birthday.
Yeah. For what purpose? Well, I would also be cautious about where I would be getting the wearable from. So if you go on some websites, they will say you own the data, you know, and so, you know, like you have to try to understand the data policy too, which is another section mm-hmm. in the book. I think some sites are getting better at having plain language policies. Normally you just sort of click here and who knows what you've just signed up for.
As you said in the book, look, I'm guessing that a lot of the companies that even say that they don't mine the data.
Yeah.
Because there's really no way of you knowing
right.
that they're mining the data. And when companies can do something, they often do them. I'm already inured to the fact that my phone listens to me all the time. Multiple companies listen to my phone, know where I am, know what I'm saying.
And that's okay for an adult.
And my watch too. Yeah, I know.
It's not okay.
For an adult.
No, I shouldn't say it's okay. It's not okay. You're aware of that. What about a child?
What about a 9-year-old?
No. Yeah, I would say I probably wouldn't be getting my 9-year-old a smartwatch.
Okay, but you would get them a smartphone because 9-year-olds around the world are getting smartphones.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be getting my 9-year-old a smartphone. And I can consider when. I mean, my daughters didn't get phones till they had to use the TTC and the Toronto Transit.
Elaine, I have grandchildren. Mm. I have a 9-year-old granddaughter. It's a different world.
Okay, it is. You're right. It is.
Ask your readers.
I say it's a tough call. You got to be, you know, you got to be connected. You got to be, you know, part of everything that's happening, but you also have to know the risks.
Yeah, they can have a phone without having a watch. The watch is, I find it very helpful for me. And that's because I take it off at night and I don't use it to monitor my sleep. Mm. It's really none of my watch's business. mm-hmm. But during the day, he's good. Mel, get up and walk around.
Yeah, for sure.
Mel, you scored a touchdown. Mel, I'm doing a lot more exercise.
That is true. It does. There is evidence that it's a good prompt for people and a good motivator to get people exercising for sure. Yeah,
absolutely.
There's value in all of them for sure. But
okay. So what do you think is going to happen? I know that you're not a futurist, but you have interviewed several, and your book is dealing with something that we only understand now. We don't know where it's going to be in 5 or 10 years. So to what extent will these wearables become part of our bodies, do you think? They're now strapped on for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part.
Yeah.
So where will they be in 5 or 10 years?
Yeah. It's hard to say. I guess in part it might depend on what level of intrusion is required. Are people going to start having surgery to have these things implanted? Probably not. But if it's, like if it's a something that's attached to your body and through sensors and that sort of thing. Do I think these things are going to be more popular? Yeah, I mean, Elon Musk is trying to have a brain implant, and he calls it like a Fitbit for your brain, where, you know, he approaching it very positively from, you know, the idea of helping people with, you know, a brain challenges, whether it's age or whether it's some other side of disease or disability. Are these things going to be happening? I mean, from what I can tell, it's far down the road. I mean, if I listen to what the experts around brain computer interface technology are talking about, that it's not anytime soon that we're going to be having brain implants in our brain, nor is it going to be happening soon that this technology will be able to read your mind, so to speak. But it's all within the realm of possibility at some point. And so that's why now we have to be talking about the ethical implications and how far do we go with the technology and what are the rules we need around them? Are they just for medical?
Does this make you more excited or more worried?
Both.
You have to choose one. That was a forced choice question.
Are you
more excited or more?
Yeah, I'm going to say I'm more excited. I'll tell you, if I was a person with a disability that could be helped by this technology, I think that value probably potentially outweighs a lot of the risk for me personally. But yeah, I think some big things need to be considered.
Imagine a scenario where some 10-year-olds have implants and they're doing really well on their exams.
And why is that? Right. Yeah. Yeah. I know.
They don't need to bring books to school.
Huge equity issues in terms of technology, you know, haves and have nots. I think that is going to be a huge issue. A lot of my work in the past was around understanding the social determinants of health and planning communities and healthcare systems to address those broader issues that are impactful on someone's health and well-being. And then I saw the line written somewhere, wearable as a social determinant of health. And I went, oh my goodness. Okay. Yes. Yes. These are huge issues that we need to talk about, you know.
So what I'm thinking is that parents of children, I'm thinking from the third grade to the sixth grade, something like that, are going to want to buy these books because children live in a wearable world.
They absolutely do.
And you've addressed so many issues, and it's a very Canadian book. I left Canada 50 years ago, but I'm still so proud.
Canadian.
To interview Canadian writers and Canadian publishers. And
what makes it a Canadian book in your view? The way it's balanced.
Yes, and the social ethic.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, Canadians worry about these things more than other people.
And that is true.
And by and large, they're more in favor of everybody having a shot and everybody having medical care and everybody. I don't want to start trashing the United States, but Canadians worry about Canadians.
That is true. Well, that's good. I'll take that as a compliment. That it's a Canadian book.
It is.
Yeah.
You can tell it's and partly because of your pride in the Canada-ness of some of the inventors and inventions.
Not every field
has Canadians at the forefront.
Yes.
But wearables does.
Yes, it does. Although many of the inventors in the book are American too, and many of those who are speaking out are American and from the large corporations. You know, the quotes in the book from Brad Smith at Microsoft and Mary Lou Jepsen, who is inventing the wearable technology that will sort of decrease the ability. Right now, you have to have an MRI machine, a magnetic resonance machine, which is hugely expensive and not available in 3/4 of the world to diagnose brain diseases. She's trying to build this into a cap, but she's very outspoken, and she has many, many interviews and podcasts and so forth that she does around the implications, the ethical implications of a technology that can one day fit in your hat and read your brain.
But Elaine, I can tell you as an inventor, we're very outspoken until a big company buys our invention. Then suddenly we become much, much quieter.
Yes, except she's actually done the opposite. She was a head.
I'm not talking about her. I'm just saying
she went from huge corporation to her own company so that she can, you know, talk about these things often at the big companies.
Exactly. Sure. So the more credits to her. Yeah. Now let's go back to your writing career. So you signed for this book with an agent or without an agent?
No agent.
No agent. So now that you're published with this fine book that's coming out in 3 weeks, are you going to get an agent? Are you submitting? Are you becoming a children's author now?
I hope so.
So how is that going for you? What are you doing now?
So I have some other projects that I've been working on. They're all in the hopper. I haven't sent anything out yet. They have some improvements. I need to make some improvements before I send
it out. Picture books?
Yes, I have one, but I can't talk about it because it's changed a million times. I have a goal of writing a picture book one day for sure. Yeah. I don't know. I don't have enough material to get an agent right now. And I'm not sure I need one right now. So many, at least Canadian publishers right now, they're all open. You don't need an agent to submit. And there's some fabulous publishers in Canada. So I'm not nearly ready for that.
Okay. I hope that in the bucket list, there's some fiction also. I'm a big believer in fiction.
Yeah.
For picture book people.
Yeah.
But maybe it's just me. I spent, 40 years as a scientist, and
I love fiction. I don't think that I don't know that after having written this book, I'm not sure I'm the right person to write a fiction book.
But you don't know until you try.
Yes. Well, I tried. the other picture books. So that wasn't
I remember yeah. Tucker and the Tiny Tales. Mm.
But I will. Yeah, we'll give it a try. Everything's on the table.
Absolutely. So listen, Elaine Cacciala from Toronto. Where in Toronto are you speaking from?
I'm in the West End, Etobicoke. Not too far, 20 minutes outside of
downtown. Etobicoke, that's not Toronto.
Yeah, sure it is. We're 20 minutes from downtown.
That's like Hamilton saying that they're in Toronto.
Oh my gosh, no. We're 25 minutes from
Hamilton. Is Toronto?
Yeah, it's all one city now. For years.
So I'm in Toronto too.
Just a little outside Toronto.
Yeah. 6,000 miles.
6,000 miles outside Toronto. Yeah.
I do hope that I will meet you. I want to congratulate you on this fine book.
Thank you.
Such a difficult subject to bring to young people, not to mention adults. And you've done such a wonderful thorough and lots of questions and not force feeding and not spoon feeding. It's really a lovely book. So hold it up again for everybody to see. Superpower, The Wearable Tech Revolution by Elaine Cacciala, brought to you by Orca, a wonderful publisher, O Canada. And it's been wonderful having you on the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network.
Oh, thank you. Elaine Cacciala,
be well, publish more books.
Thank you.
And I'll be happy to interview you when they are out also.
Well, thank you again. And thank you for the opportunity.
I believe in you. I think you're going to be.
Thank you. Thank you.
I mean, if you stay the course, you will be a terrific author. And
perseverance is
first,
a key.
Yes. And I will have been the first person to interview you and to tell everybody that you are going to be very famous.
Thank you.
So thanks so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.